On a Monday, it is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at the policy agenda of a children's mental health advocacy group. It's called Wisconsin Family Ties. Governor Evers' two-year spending plan proposes a big boost to education funding, including $47 million more in mental health aid for schools. DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, also seeks more aid for trauma sensitivity school training. DPI published newly available data on the use of seclusion and restraint in schools. Nearly half of all Wisconsin schools reported at least one incident where either seclusion or physical restraint was used last school year. Has your child been secluded or restrained? How did you feel afterward? How has your school approached such practices? It's 800-642-1234. Hugh Davis is Executive Director of Wisconsin Family Ties. Hugh, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much for having me.
Why is having this data on the use of isolation and restraint tactics in our schools, why is that important to you?
First and foremost, I think it's important because the visibility has resulted in us talking today, Kate. Mm-hmm. Prior to this, there was no statewide reporting of these incidents. And so even though we knew what was going on, we did public records requests for about 3 years worth of data, which found that there were roughly 20,000 incidents of seclusion and restraint every year, and that the very vast majority, about 80%, were happening with students with disabilities. And when we talked to individuals about this, we talk about the incidents of seclusion and restraint. They would say usually, well, that's not happening here, is it? And then we'd tell them that it happens about 20,000 times each year in schools, and they were totally shocked. And yet there was no, because it was us having to get a public records request to get that data, there was no widespread understanding of that. So in the update of the law in 2020, we felt it was really important to have visibility about this. And so I think it's borne out by the number of newspaper articles that have been written and the fact that we're talking about it today. And hopefully the next step then is for us to actually do something about that and use more humane, more compassionate ways to deal with challenging behavior.
So these tactics, you say, of using seclusion and restraint happening with 80% with students with disabilities, 4 out of 5 times these tactics are used, it's with a student with a disability.
Yes. Yeah.
What is going on
specifically
there?
There's not a incredible insight into the data because the data just reports that information. So it's a little hard to disaggregate that and to come up with any other conclusions specifically. But we do believe that a significant portion of this is used with children who have emotional or behavioral challenges. They're the ones most likely to have challenging behavior in school settings, be less compliant than most other students. And unfortunately, compliance is a major trigger to these incidents occurring. I think that that's probably why we're seeing this mostly with students with disabilities. The other thing that is that we found in our multiple years of public records requests, that it was also the vast majority of these techniques were used on younger students, elementary age students. Hmm. And so that's another issue that we could clearly take a look at in trying to reduce the utilization of these techniques.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a state law that requires schools to now report whenever they isolate or restrain students. We're talking about it with Hugh Davis, who is Executive Director of Wisconsin Family Ties, which pushed, an organization which pushed for the law. What do you think about the use of isolation and restraints in schools? Should these practices be banned? Should there be exceptions for certain situations? 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned, Hugh, the elementary level, and several elementary schools reported hundreds of cases involving these practices in the 2019-2020 school year. How concerned are you that students are being isolated or restrained too often?
Very concerned about that. I think that if you would look at the research, particularly around seclusion, there has been absolutely no benefit found to secluding a student. There is federal legislation that's been introduced several times, has not passed, it's called Keeping All Students Safe Act, and that act would actually ban the use of seclusion. That is an approach that we at Wisconsin Family Ties support. We don't think there's any reason to seclude a child. So I think that that would help. If you take a look at the number of incidents that DPI reported, that would cut the number in about half if we took out the seclusion. When it comes to restraint, that's a little more challenging, and we're not saying that those measures should be banned, but we do believe that we ought to look more critically at when restraint is used. Restraint should be used as a last resort when nothing else has helped and when someone's safety is at imminent risk. And so in those cases, it is absolutely warranted. And we want people to be able to restrain someone who is either going to hurt themselves or hurt someone else. That is reasonable. It's common sense. And so we're not looking to ban restraint altogether, but we are looking at or wanting people to look at it more critically.
Yeah, so putting parameters around when it's used and when it is not appropriate. More than 1,000 schools in the state reported no incidents of isolation or restraints last school year. Could this mean schools are not properly reporting the incidents? What's going on there?
It's possible. I don't want to make any kind of, I don't want to speculate about that. But when we collected our data beginning in the 2013-14 school year, we saw a similar kind of response where we had schools that were either not reporting, did not respond to the public records request at all, or were reporting no incidents. And while I think that's perfectly possible, the likelihood of it seemed pretty long, given the fact of how prevalent the use of seclusion and restraint was in other school districts.
Do you think that there needs to be some clarifying legislation to improve the state's tracking of isolation and restraints, or so schools know exactly how to properly report it?
Well, the latest update, which was 2019 Act 118, did provide a lot of clarification.
Okay.
And so the clarification should already be there in state law. I think that it might be, this is the first year that this data has been reported to DPI. So there may be some additional training that is needed to make sure that schools are fully understanding what their requirements are under the law. But the clarification was provided in that act.
Hugh Davis, he heads up Wisconsin Family Ties. It's an organization that helps families with children who have mental health challenges. What do you think of a proposed ban on restricting minors in courtrooms for most cases? On restraining minors in courtrooms in most cases. How could lawmakers or state agencies help improve access to youth mental health services? What's working in your community? Where has your family felt stuck in getting help? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about youth mental health and the policy agenda of an organization that provides peer support to families with children who have mental health challenges. Wisconsin Family Ties was founded more than 30 years ago by a group of parents who wanted to improve children's mental health. What do you think of Governor Evers' state budget proposal to boost mental health aid to schools? What do you think of schools using physical restraint and seclusion tactics? 800-642-1234. Hugh Davis is executive director of Wisconsin Family Ties. He's with us for 10 more minutes. Let's go to Belinda now in Phillips. Hi, Belinda. What would you like to say?
Hi, good morning. So I have a special needs child. He's in second grade now. And we've been to a couple of different schools in the northern region up here. So he actually had a couple incidents where he was restrained and or isolated at a school when he was in first grade. His behavior seriously declined. We were having more issues with him. And then we transferred over to a new school where they really kind of shy away from using those at all costs. And it's been amazing to see his development and growth. So I just happened to see, as a parent, just the deficit that some of those restraints and isolations had for him.
Belinda, thank you so much for sharing your personal perspective on this. A second grader with special needs and switched to a new school that isn't using the physical restraint and seclusion tactics. Hugh?
Yeah, well, I think that certainly shows, unfortunately, it's the experience of many parents and families in our state, way too many in my mind. But it also shows that it's not the kid that we have to worry about changing or fixing. It's that the difference can be made by adult attitudes, actions, and approaches. When we as adults alter what we do, because let's face it, the only behavior that we can control is our own. As much as we'd like to control someone else's, it's ourselves that we have the power over. When those adults take a look at what they're doing and their approaches and attitudes, kids improve. It's been proven time and time again. There's tons of research on it. And yet we tend to want to use these consequence-based approaches that, by and large, will work with neurotypical kids quite a bit, but not with kids who have, not with students with disabilities. Just does not work.
Let's bring in Susan now in Richland Center. Susan is a special education teacher. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just have a few things to say. First of all, every teacher has gone through a CPI training if you're going to have to restrain a student. And in that training, the last thing you ever do is you don't want to restrain a student. First of all, you lose that trust for them. You embarrass the student. There's a chance of both of you getting in hurt. And you do have to report. It does not matter. If you put a student in seclusion for 5 minutes because they need that time to calm down, or if you restrain, you have to do a report. And then the parents know about it. We don't advertise it. Not everybody has to know. But I just wish once in a while people need to come into the schools and actually see what's going on. So, you know, it is getting reported. This is a waste of time. And I just wish once in a while we would hear what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. We don't just restrain it. It has to be documented. It's the law. And it happens. And there are kids who cannot control their temper, and it has to happen for the safety of everybody. But it's the last resort.
Yes, Susan, thank you so much for bringing your perspective and, you know, saying that, look, this is last resort, Hugh.
It should be last resort, as I said earlier, and I'm not saying that we should ban restraint. She's right. According to the law, you do have to report it. I do think that there are lots of places across the nation who have dramatically reduced the use of seclusion and restraint. I think that you know, we should not think that we here in Wisconsin are so unique that we can't look at those same kinds of approaches. And so I would disagree with some of that that says that everything that is happening is necessary. We do know when we delve into some of these situations that the underlying issue starts with some sort of noncompliance. To me, noncompliance is not a reason to restrain a student. The time when you restrain is when it is a last resort. She also mentioned training that that school staff need to receive in order to restrain. So I'll just relate what a professor from one of the UW system universities told us a couple of years ago as we were looking into this situation, that they used that most prevalent training with their students who were going to go out to do their student teaching. And while it's true that that training does emphasize de-escalation over the use of restraint, it does teach how to restrain students. And what this professor found was that when the students were coming back from or talking about their student teaching experiences, one of the things that they were doing was they were talking about which restraint holds they used. That shocked the professor. And so what they have done is they've stopped training on how to restrain children. Mm-hmm. They train on the de-escalation part, but they've stopped using the restraint section of that training.
We are talking about youth mental health with Hugh Davis, Executive Director of Wisconsin Family Ties. The group advocates for parents of children with behavioral and emotional challenges. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Hugh, I want to switch gears here for a moment. You know, families have been under incredible stress this past year in the pandemic. Your organization provides that peer support for families. How do you help families through these times? What have you been hearing? What do you say and do?
I'll answer that in just one second. Kate, I did want to go back because the teacher who spoke mentioned something I think was important, saying that she wished that people would talk about the positive things that they do. And I can talk about that in terms of the pandemic. But I do want to say that I am probably one of the biggest supporters of public education in our state. Both of my parents were teachers. My brother is a teacher. My sister-in-law is a teacher. And my one of my kids, my daughter, second daughter, is doing her student teaching right now to become a special education teacher. So I am an absolute strong supporter of public education in our state. I've testified for public education. I've protested for public education. So I am incredibly in awe of what teachers do on a daily basis. And when it comes to the pandemic, you know, we put more pressure on the education system than any other system, I believe. You know, they had to pivot on a weekend and go from in-person schooling to virtual schooling. And now many schools have hybrid school models where teachers are expected to engage students virtually as well as those in a classroom. So kudos to all teachers for hanging in there in what has got to be one of the most difficult times education has ever seen.
You go ahead. So, on the family component, how are you helping right now with these families in the stress they're experiencing?
Yes. So Wisconsin Family Ties probably had a little bit of an advantage over some other organizations because we have a geographically decentralized workforce. All of our parent peer specialists is what we call them. Are spread throughout the state, working out of their home offices, serving families in their local communities. So we managed our own internal organization virtually. We used the technology available. We used Zoom, phone, email, whatever we had to in order to manage our organization. So it was fairly easy for us to turn to use those same technologies that we had always been using to work with families. So we continued to do the same things that we always have done in providing support for those families, emotional support for those families, in helping them navigate really complex systems, helping them get their needs met, and providing some training and coaching along the way. So we've done all of those things. I will say, though, it has been more difficult, especially as people get burned out on the virtual model. There are, you know, everything is virtual. And I think we're now starting, you know, we've experienced for some time now, people who are not willing to have the same depth of conversation that they were in person over technology. So we're looking forward to the end of the pandemic when we can meet face to face with those families.
Hugh, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate. I really appreciate the time.
Hugh Davis is Executive Director of Wisconsin Family Ties. It is the Memorial Day edition of the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're taking you to the State House to hear from a tribal leader. John Johnson Sr. is president of Lacta Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. He delivered this year's State of the Tribes address earlier this month. This annual speech began 17 years ago as a way to improve communication between First Nations and the Wisconsin state government. WPR host Keely Baltina explored some of the moments in President Johnson's speech and assembled these highlights.
Bonjour, Ndindwe Magani Doug. Hello, my name is John D. Johnson, Sr. My Ojibwe name is Wane Wantane Gijik. It means when night time and the morning meet for the first time at the break of day.
Johnson wore a mask in the state assembly chamber as he told Wisconsin lawmakers and elected officials that his goal was to create a better understanding of Native people, culture, and traditions.
One of the biggest misconceptions about tribes involves the impact of a casino has on the health and wealth of a tribe. Tribes do not have a traditional tax base to generate government revenue. Many people think any tribe with a casino sits on the top of never-ending pile of cash. There's a wide range of factors that determine how far casino revenue goes towards self-reliance. However, some tribes are better off than others. But most people fail to realize casino revenue supports much of the tribe's government services. Many of those services, like roads, bridges, public safety, sewer, water, and others are enjoyed by Native people and non-Natives alike. When you consider that casino revenue makes possible all the tribal services typically associated with a national government, the revenue stream quickly reaches its limits. Economic support, homeless shelters, land management, housing, medical, dental, and education, cultural entities, and just about every other service you would associate with governing is provided by the tribes.
Johnson acknowledged economic loss in the pandemic. He also noted its human toll and mentioned the recent workplace shooting at the Oneida Casino Complex, which left two people dead.
This only reinforces the need for expanding mental and behavioral health services. This is an event we see repeated across the United States. It can call at any one of our doorsteps. At this time, I would like to take a moment of silence and remember those we lost during this pandemic.
Johnson said tribal communities are seeing an increase in drug overdoses during the pandemic.
Fentanyl and meth remain an issue, that impacts our entire region. Drugs are killing people in northern Wisconsin and across the country. Drugs don't discriminate. And neither do we when prosecuting anyone found involved in dealing drugs within our jurisdictions. Yet the flow of drugs into the Northwoods has escalated during the pandemic as mental health, economic, and social challenges exert growing pressure on our people and families. For years, the tribe has advocated and pursued strong enforcement and strong prosecution of criminals. We have partnered with county governments on drug courts and reentry programs to help fight repeat offenses, creating a path forward for a healthy, productive life. As we will continue to fight drug abuse and related illegal activities alongside our region, state, and federal partners. And as being tribal chairman of Lac des Flambeaux, when we have that MRT program down in Vilas County, I think it's the only one in the state where they have drug rehab in there. And I make it a point when somebody graduates to show up there, whether they're tribal or non-tribal. And I was thinking maybe it'd be better if some of the other leadership showed up as a, you know, also from a different county's levels and stuff. You know, because we've got to give our people a little bit of hope somewhere down the line, you know, and it's always a good thing. And some people succeed when they come out of there. We offer them jobs back home, you know, we offer them a place to stay. You know, we try to make things right so that this doesn't happen again. But I just wanted to mention that for our people back home who are struggling. It's important, however, that we recognize this not only as a Native issue. Drug abuse of both prescription and illegal substances is a growing threat across the Northwoods.
Johnson highlighted work that's brought First Nations and non-tribal communities together.
Most recently, we collaborated with our neighbors in the Northwoods to change the name of Squaw Lake. I know from my own experiences, I've been on council for like 6-7 years now, and but before this had been tried for almost 30 years to get this name changed. And the people that we talked with on the Lakes Association came forward with us when we spoke about it, and it was a great thing that we collaborated together. And I'm very proud of the two men that made it happen on the Lakes Association side, because they did all the legwork around the lake. Even though there was a few racist people that still think it should stay the same, the rest of them said, you know, Galween, no, we need to change this now. So that's a very proud day for us. And when things settle down a little bit and it finally starts to warm up in northern Wisconsin, we're probably going to have a little ceremony for that lake and our women back home, which we hold high regards for our women, and that lake name was very derogatory towards them. So everybody is welcome when we get that set up. So think of the worst name somebody could call your wife, your mother, your daughter, your sister, your aunt, niece, and granddaughter. That's what Squaw means to the Native women and girls. All women and girls deserve to be treated with respect and held in high regards. All women and girls deserve to live within an environment free of disrespectful terms and imagery.
Johnson continued by explaining that names, that words, have power.
We believe everyone can agree there is offensive terms in every language that should not be used to describe women and girls. Squaw is one of those terms. The lack of respect and dignity extends beyond an offensively named lake. However, the shame of seeing it every day and the self-image impresses on Native girls and women, unacceptable. It leads to harmful effects beyond poor self-worth. It underpins a significant trend we are seeing towards greater numbers of murdered and missing Native women. There are people who believe here that we are less than human. They believe it is acceptable to murder, rape, and abduct Native women and girls. This and many other reasons drive our ongoing efforts to retire offensive and demeaning names and mascots. This is not an act of political correctness, as some would describe our efforts. It's a very real threat to our people and our ability to achieve and contribute fully to both worlds we walk in.
Johnson turned his attention to the environment. The president said Native American communities welcome jobs and economic development, but that tribes are unwilling to sacrifice the health of natural resources, including earth, air, and water.
Until there are proven protections in place for public health, safety, and natural resources, mining must be rejected as a common threat to all. We know for certain a Flambeau mine, which mining proponents say is a successful mine, is responsible for Flambeau River tributaries currently being classified as impaired and toxic, according to the Wisconsin DNR. Think about your favorite Wisconsin vacation spot. Would you want your children swimming in acid lakes and rivers? Would you eat fish from polluted waters? The DNR has issued fish health advisories warning people about eating fish in every area across the state. This is a constant fight to protect and preserve natural resources. It is a battle with many fronts. Mining is just one. As a tribe, our environmental standards exceed federal and state standards for environmental protection. For hundreds of years, we have taken up the charge to protect and preserve the environment for generations yet to experiencing these life-sustaining natural resources.
Among other themes, Johnson talked about treaty rights, Native American mascots, racism, and the relationship between sovereign First Nations and state officials.
That was WPR host Keely Baltina recapping some of the moments from this year's State of the Tribes address. President John Johnson Sr. delivered the annual speech. He's president of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. You can find Johnson's archived full address at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with the voice of another tribal leader. We hear from the president of the Stockbridge Munsee Community Band of Mohican Indians, Shannon Holsey. On this Memorial Day, it is the voices of tribal leaders on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Shannon Holsey is president of the Stockbridge Munsee Community Band of Mohican Indians. The reservation is in central Wisconsin. WPR host Keely Baltina spoke to Holsey. She first asked how racial injustice affects the connections between Native and non-Native communities. Here's what Holsey said.
Oppression is all interconnected, and it's not indicative of anything else. I know, like, we're right now facing, you know, this crisis of, you know, a country that's divided, and much of it is around the fact that it is intertwined to racism. You know, there are so many obstacles and indifference and discrimination to people with diverse backgrounds, and they face that daily. The fact that racism has been a part of America since its founding, and really has been used as a manipulative tool to oppress and marginalize non-Caucasian people for centuries. And really understanding this reality requires a reminder of really how we've arrived at this point. You know, I don't really need to recite what the history of racial injustice in this country is, but we really do need to remind ourselves that all of these disparities exist, you know, and, you know, that sort of invisibility around, you know, some of those issues, you know, especially as it relates to Native communities. You know, for decades, we lacked representation information about Native people, which were damaging myths and stereotypes, like things with mascots and And in Wisconsin, the need for building out a more robust Act 31, you know, that's more led by speaking Native, the Native narrative to challenge those negative narratives and surround, you know, communities, making sure that there is accuracy and authentic portrayals of making sure Native communities are represented both in history and culture and in media. You know, I think right now, many of our children attend schools where information about Native Americans is either completely absent from the classroom, are relegated to brief mentions or negative information or inaccurate stereotypes. And this really results in an enduring and damaging narrative regarding Native people and tribal nations and their citizens. There are some exceptional efforts happening. I know that there was a very robust campaign around making sure that they brought through Act 31 accurate and culturally responsive and tribal specific contemporary content about Native Americans into mainstream educational systems. But, you know, a lot of things really need to be done. You know, some of the top research finds that invisibility is the modern form of bias against Native Americans. Many Americans are not clear about how many Native American people exist, kind of like, you know, sort of the adage, you know, I'm my nation is the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians, sort of like the narrative of the last Mohicans, because it's in, you know, in mainstream society depicted in a movie, somehow people think that Native Americans don't exist like the last of the Mohicans. But I assure you, we are not the last. You know, and those that invisibility I talked about is one of the biggest barriers that Native people face in advocating not only for tribal sovereignty, equity, and social justice, but just being a larger part of the narrative, you know, and finding ways to show how that invisibility and stereotypes and false narratives underlie the stories being told right now about Native American people in the 21st century.
Shannon Holsey is president of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of the Mohican Nation. That tribal reservation is in central Wisconsin, and we're talking about issues, challenges, and opportunities facing American Indians in Wisconsin. You're listening to the Ideas Network. President Holsey, we know this pandemic is disproportionately affecting people of color. We know specifically that Black Americans are suffering more than white people as a group. What has the response to COVID-19 looked like in Indigenous communities?
When you speak of disproportionate, you know, Native American communities are extremely vulnerable. And I think COVID-19 and its response really brought to light the vulnerabilities that existed in Native communities. But it also spoke to the resiliency and the response to how we jumped to action and really were able to really enjoin our state partners like Governor Evers and his administration in terms of how we were going to battle this, from initial onset of it to making sure that we did everything possible to keep our communities safe, to having multiple shutdowns, even at our own expense, to robust campaigns around the need to vaccinate so that we can get to that herd immunity, so that we can start to return to some level of normalcy and safety. So we were all in it together, and it continues to be. And I'm very appreciative of that. But Native Americans, because of the disproportionate challenges, both health-wise and from an economic standard, I think dealt with it very, very diligently. But also, it wasn't something singular. It was something that collectively tribal nations worked collaboratively with our state legislatures and our governor to make sure that we got through this and continue to. But we really don't know the long-term effects it has on people. And quite honestly, losing one person's life to COVID-19, in my opinion, is too many.
What does economic recovery look like on the tribal level?
It's not, you know, as tribal nations, many of the tribal nations in the state of Wisconsin are some of the largest employers. So there is parity to the comparison of that of any other industry that was really adversely affected by COVID-19, you know, and in dealing with the pandemic, you're also dealing with closure, which equates to loss of revenues. And so, you know, what we're looking to is, you know, we're always looking to ways to collaborate. You know, I know Governor Evers has robustly been inclusive of his desire to look at economic recovery collectively, that he looked at our state in its totality. And that, along with previous to that, the CARES Act and now the American Jobs Plan and the American Rescue Plan, I think we all have to look, you know, to how we build back Wisconsin better in terms of we have to look at right now building back our antiquated infrastructures and bringing back of our jobs or new jobs as a result of the current market or the conditions of what's happening. And of course, you know, when you think of infrastructure, it's not just roads and bridges and those types of things, but it's also about making sure that we have, like, for example, an expansion of broadband. Anybody listening today will understand that a majority of Wisconsin's counties are rural, and many of us lack access to broadband. And many of us have found in the past year the innate need to have it, you know, and we need to really invest in Wisconsin's physical infrastructure and workforce and spark innovation, not only with like manufacturing, but also looking in ways to invest in our children and our families and helping them cover their basic expenses, because really so many of them struggle. And I know we all recognize we all need to do more. You know, you're not going to just immediately find economic recovery after a pandemic. You know, we need to work collectively as some of the largest employers along, you know, with our state partners in building a stronger economy that doesn't leave anybody behind. And, you know, we really have to make sure that there's inclusiveness of bringing everyone along, inclusive of gender, race, place of residence, urban, suburban, or rural, whatever that looks like.
What's happened with tourism for First Nations over the last year? Because tourism is an important piece of the economic puzzle.
It really is, as we rely on tourism and that mechanism of marketing, much like the Wisconsin State Tourism Department does. And it's been devastating, you know, because our operations have been reduced to 30%, you know, and of course, our communities have, for the most part, up until maybe a month or so ago, primarily closed with limited operations. So it has been extremely challenging. And so we've used this past year to really redevelop that element of tourism and redefine how we were going to do that through really robust marketing, making sure that in a safe way, there was outreach to many communities to see how there would be collaboration and effort to build back better, not only tribal nations, but the state of Wisconsin as well, because there's parity in all of it. When the state of Wisconsin does well, tribal nations do well as well.
What else do you want people across the state to understand? Because the things you're talking about are a lot of work.
But I'm inspired and I'm hopeful. I'm extremely hopeful, you know, because Native American people are resilient. And they have always been, and they always manage. They always, you know, at the heart of everything we do is our culture, our language, and our traditions. And that's what's our, you know, our North Star. It guides us in everything we do. So although challenging, we always find a way.
President Holsey, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Shannon Holsey talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. Holsey is president of the Stockbridge Muncie Community Band of Mohican Indians. She delivered the State of the Tribes address in 2017. Coming up on the morning show, we reflect on the legacy of Confederate soldiers buried in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.